So for the last 4 weeks, we have been looking at different aspects of God. And I can summarize it this way. He is over us as our King. He is for us as our Father. He is with us as our friend. And He is in us as our lover. Those are the four aspects. Originally, I was going to finish after the fourth aspect, but when I pondered about how to tie it all up together, I realized that there has to be one more aspect of God that we have to address, and that is God as our servant. He serves us as a servant. And so He is underneath us as our servant. And by that, I don't mean that He's not worthy, obviously, or worth less than us, but that He undergirds us in serving and in supporting us. And there's no better description or illustration in the Bible than the passage that Joanna just read today. Jesus being a servant and putting a towel around Him like a bellhop and washing the disciples' feet. And so from this, He demonstrated what it means to be a servant, or what it means how to live like a servant. And so outline for this message goes like this. First of all, how did He teach this servanthood? Number one, He demonstrated it. Number two, He connected it. And number three, He entrusted it. Okay, so first of all, He demonstrates servanthood. He demonstrates servanthood. LD, can we turn on the lights? Thank you. He demonstrates servanthood. First of all, who is it? We have to consider, who is it that is demonstrating how to be a servant? Who's doing the demonstration? Verse 3 says this, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into His hands and that He had come from God and was going back to God. Okay? Knowing that Father has given Him all things. Knowing this, He rose from supper, He laid aside His outer garment and taking a towel and tied it around His waist, and He's about to be a bellhop. He's about to be a maid to His inferiors, who are His disciples. Now, the Bible says, Jesus, knowing that all things had been given. Another passage says, all authority on heaven and earth had been given to Me. Do you know what that means? That means God the Father, the Almighty, Creator God, has given His power, unlimited power, to His Son, Jesus Christ. So at this point, Jesus is in power. Not a puny power, like the emperor of Rome at that moment, who controlled half the world for about 30, 40 years of time. But no, Jesus had control over, at this point, every molecule in the universe. He had absolute, unlimited power. If you watch Bruce Almighty, you can kind of relate to what kind of power Jesus might have had. Of course, He didn't have power over absolutely everything. But Jesus, at this point, did. And what will this God in flesh do with this kind of power that had been brought back to Him? Now, it's not that Jesus earned this power. No, when He left heaven, He always had this power with His Father, right? But when He came to earth, He laid aside this power. And now this power had been given back to Jesus. And so what does He do with this kind of unlimited power? He kneels down and washes His disciples' feet like a slave. That's what this Jesus does. And this washing of the feet was a menial task, not even fit for a Jewish slave. It was only reserved for foreign slaves, because even the Jewish slaves were too, it would be dishonoring their own countrymen. So they did not make their own countrymen, you know, who are servants and slaves, do this. Only the foreign slave would do this kind of menial task. You see, back then, unlike today, the roads weren't paved. Red clay, dirty, dusty, especially if it rains, and they wore sandals everywhere, and so your feet would get red with mud. And whenever they go to a home, they would be given water, a basin of water, so that they can wash their own feet normally, most of the time. However, if you're a special guest, then the slave or the servant of the house will be ordered to wash the guest's feet. And that servant better not be even a Hebrew or a Jewish servant. It better be a foreign, no-life, low-life, less-than-animal type of person. And so for Jesus, who is Jesus? All power and authority had been given to Him. He is the King of the universe. He has control over every single molecule on this earth, and He becomes the lowest form of a human being. being a slave and washing the feet of the disciples. This makes President Obama coming over to your house in the middle of the night to fix your toilet look like high class. That's what's going on here. And you can hear it in the dumbfound expression of his disciples, especially Peter. Do not undignify yourself like this, Jesus. You will never wash my, I will not allow you to dishonor yourself like this. Respect your position, man, right? You've been saying you're the Messiah. You do not do this. Because it didn't make sense for somebody like Jesus or anybody to be doing what he was doing, the menial task of a foreign slave. So consider who it is that is demonstrating this servanthood. Number two, what is he demonstrating? Consider what Jesus is demonstrating. He's just demonstrating how to be low. Exactly opposite of what we aspire to do and achieve. What do we tell our children to do from the time they are born? Aim high, right? Dream big. You can do whatever you can achieve whatever you put your mind to. Be the head and not the tail. My mama used to always tell me, right? Be somebody, be the head, be the prominent figure. Don't be a servant, don't be a lowly person. But Jesus turns it upside down and tells us to be a servant. Now, let me see how prevalent this thought is in your head, right? Do you often find yourself fantasizing or daydreaming as you're doing your job, especially as you encounter your boss? Do you ever think to yourself, you know, if I'm the boss, I can do that so much better? Ever been there? Maybe you're a teenager and you're in your classroom and you're thinking, you know, if I'm the teacher, I'll be so much more fun than that teacher. I'll teach so much better, right? Or about your parents. If I'm the parent, I'll never say that my mama is saying or my dad is saying. I'll never do that. I'll let my child do this. In other words, you know you can be a better mom or dad than your mom or dad. What are you doing? You're really seeking for power. Did you know that? If you ever, in your work, right, you're looking at your boss and you go, man, I can do that so much better. And I have to admit, you know, I've been a youth pastor for a bunch of years and I'm sitting in my meeting and I'm thinking in my head, you know, if I'm the senior pastor, right, I can handle that so much. I wouldn't do that. Now that I'm the senior pastor, right, or lead pastor, I yes, you know, that humbled me a great deal. And so now I have a lot more respect for leaders. But whenever we think like that, what we're really craving for is, listen, what we are really craving for is power. We want more power. And if we're given more power, we would know exactly how we would use it, right? But what does Jesus do? How does Jesus use his unlimited power? Does he use it to lord it over people? To command people what to do? Do this, don't do that. Do it this way, not that way. No. He puts himself underneath all of them, beneath all of them, and serves them as a servant. Listen, this is not popular. People don't want to hear this, right? I know that. Consider at least three characteristics of a servant. Number one, anonymity. Nobody knows a servant. Nobody recognizes a servant. Number two, low desirability. Nobody wants to be it. When I grow up, I want to be a garbage man, no kid would say. Right? Number three, manual labor. It's tiring physically to be a servant, and that's exactly what Jesus became to the disciples. He is pounding it into his disciples' head to become servants, and he does this by demonstrating in a most powerful way. Luke 22:24 gives us a different, slightly different version. Who is the greatest? Jesus asked the disciples, because disciples, right before he was to be captured and he was to die, they were talking to each other. Who is the greatest in the kingdom of God, right? I'm the greatest, you're the greatest, or he's the greatest. And this is what Jesus says. A dispute arose among them as to which one of them would be regarded as the greatest. And he, Jesus, said to the disciples, the kings of the Gentiles, that is non-Jews, exercise lordship over them, and those in authority over them are called benefactors. But not so with you, my children, he says. Rather, let the greatest among you become as the youngest. In that culture, youngest had no voice. The oldest were the wise, and they are the ones who led everything. So become like the youngest, he says, and the leader as one who serves. So if you're a leader, be a servant. Don't lord it over other people. Don't can people just because you don't like them, because you are the boss. Come underneath them, is what Jesus is saying. And that's exactly what he's demonstrating physically by washing the feet of the disciples. And what is the motivation for this demonstration? Why is he doing this? Verse 1 tells us that it is love. He is motivated by love to serve his disciple. He has no other ulterior motive. Right? He's not one of these politicians who are kissing babies and who are doing menial things just so that he can become this great person and then he can lord over them. He's not like that. He's truly motivated by love. Verse 1 says, "Now, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end." He loved them to the end. And then after that, saying that, Jesus is found washing the disciples' feet. And so that's how he demonstrates his love for them, by serving them. You see? You serve somebody that you love. We naturally serve people that we love. Moms and dads serve your children by making food for them and by buying things for them, by teaching them sometimes lessons that are painful. Teachers do the same thing. You would teach the children, not just so that you can get paid, but if you genuinely love them, you find yourself serving them. We serve one another because of love, and that's really the only right motivation or the motive to serve. And we try to do that here at As One, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that at the end, which I'm so glad for. You know, I'm not a great cook by any stretch of the imagination. I have never really cooked in my life. I only know how to cook one thing, and that is this Korean noodle soup. And all you got to do is put water and soup and, you know, and then boil it for 5 minutes, and you're done. That's the only thing that I know how to cook. But since the beginning of September, I've started doing something that I've never done in my life before, and that is to make hot breakfast for my girls. Every morning, 5 days a week, with eggs and toast sometimes, and, you know, it's hot breakfast. And I'm like, why am I doing this? Sometimes I'm doing this in the morning, right, and making coffee for my wife and so on. It's because I love them. I want to serve them. I want to do this. And I also want them to learn from, you know, from myself. Of course, they learn this from my wife all the time because she has almost a full-time job and she's constantly serving the family. But I also want them to learn from their daddy as well. That I'm not just this person that goes to work and then comes home and then does nothing but watch football all the time, but I'm actually here to make you breakfast every morning, right? So that they will have that heart of a servanthood in their hearts. Why? Once again, love. Love motivates it, okay? And Jesus demonstrated it. Number two, not only did he demonstrate it, but he connected to the past. Regarding the servanthood, he connects servanthood to the past. What do I mean by that? Jesus didn't do anything in vacuum. For me, the strongest evidence for the existence of God is not all the ontological, teleological, existential, epistemological kind of arguments. And if you totally missed on what those words mean, don't worry about it. Okay, there are a whole bunch of arguments, and I know a whole bunch of them, is what I'm saying, as to why I think, why people believe God exists. But none of those things are the reason why I believe God exists. Really, the strongest, for me, strongest evidence that God is God of the Bible is the God that truly exists is the Bible. When I read the Bible, when I deeply meditate upon it, especially how the Old Testament plays off with the New Testament. What is indicated, what is promised in the Old Testament, and you see it being fulfilled in the New Testament 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 years later, exactly how it was predicted and how it was implied, then I go, this has to be no other factor than God. It has to be God. So to me, for me, the Bible and how it fulfills itself is the greatest evidence as to why I believe that God exists, and I'm willing to bet my life on it. And I discovered one of those things because I was reminded by another pastor as I was listening to his sermon that everything in the Bible really is not about us. It's not about how to make our lives better. It's not about how we are supposed to behave. It's not even about how we are to worship God. But it's actually about Jesus Christ. It's about his son, what he has done for us, and therefore how we can benefit from that. We are not the main characters in the Bible. Bible is not really written about us. It's about his son, Jesus Christ. And then when we know that it's about Jesus Christ, we strangely benefit from that. And I was reminded of that once again. And here's what you do. Whenever you come across a passage in the New Testament, especially regarding Jesus, if you don't quite understand why he did certain thing he did, like a miracle or something, you got to question, okay, you know, I think he's trying to fulfill something, a promise or something that was stated in the Old Testament at his time, that he's somehow trying to make a realization of something that was predicted. In other words, it was prefaced in the Old Testament. So try to look for what it is that he's trying to fulfill. For example, why, we told you this many times, why is it that Jesus performed as the very first miracle, inaugural miracle, the turning of the water into wine? Why that one? Why was it so important? And we said, because it's all about the wedding feast, right? The book of Revelation ends with the marriage supper of the Lamb at the very end. So Jesus is trying to actually predict that future event. And of course, in Hosea too, right, that God is the bridegroom and the church is the bride. And he's also trying to demonstrate that in that wedding feast. And so you can make that connection. But what about this one? What about washing of disciples' feet the night before he was to be captured and he was going to be killed? That is very strange if you think about it. Why would Jesus do that on that very last night on earth? Why would he pick that particular event to have happened? I mean, it's almost like if I know that I'm going to die tomorrow, I wouldn't call you guys up and say, hey, I'm going to come over to your house and I want to fix up your sewer. Right? Because that's a menial, dirty task. I wouldn't do that. It's very strange why Jesus would do this on his last night. And so you got to think, okay, what is he trying to fulfill? What is there a parallel passage in the Old Testament or an event in the Old Testament that he is trying to fulfill? So I did this, and anybody can do this. I went online, went to esvbible.org, so you guys all have an access to it if you have internet access, and I typed in wash. Okay, it gives you the Bible, and then it basically gives you all the occurrences of the word wash in the Bible. And I just scanned through, and I found something. In Exodus chapter 40, verse 30. Let me set you up this way. And it's a stark parallel. It's a stunning parallel. And when I, this spoke to me, and I read this at Starbucks, and I wanted to kneel down when I discovered this on my knees in front of all those people and just worship God. Instead, I just walked out and went to Sports Authority. And there, I wanted to once again bow down and worship God. And so I just drove myself to a park, and I truly worshiped God when I realized this, what he was doing, what Jesus was doing by washing the feet of the disciples. He wasn't just being a humble servant. He wasn't just demonstrating it. No, he was connecting it to the past. And the past is this. Moses, in Exodus chapter 40, it's the very last chapter of Exodus, Moses is given instruction on how to sacrifice unto the Lord that is acceptable to God. Now, Passover, if you're not familiar, Passover started in the Jewish calendar when Israelites were sent out of Egypt, and God did that by plaguing and killing all the firstborn. And to do that, the Israelites had to put blood over the doorpost, and when the spirit of death came over, and if the spirit saw the blood on the doorpost, it would simply pass over that household, and then it would kill everybody else. And so all the Egyptian firstborns were killed, but none of the Israelite firstborns were killed. And so they got saved, and they came out of Egypt, and they became God's children, and they went to the current Israel's location where they are still occupying right now. So that's the context behind the Passover. Now, a year after they came out to celebrate that, they celebrate what's called a Passover, right? To celebrate that huge event. And to do that, they created this tabernacle. It's like a big temple thing, but it's made out of tent because they're in the desert. And to serve it, you can only have certain priests, okay, that are brothers of Moses and his sons. Only they can go in there once a year to sacrifice an animal to signify the animal that was killed in order to save them. Okay? So, Exodus 40:30. This is what it says. He said, that's God, set the basin between the tent of meeting and the altar, and the water in it for washing, with which Moses and Aaron and his sons washing their hands and their feet When they went into the tent of meeting and when they approached the altar, they washed as the Lord commanded Moses. Moses, priests, washed their hands and feet before they sacrificed the animal to commemorate God saving them. Got that? Jesus, as he's celebrating Passover with his disciples, he knew that he would die the next day as the sacrificial lamb, is washing the feet of the disciples. What is he doing? He, as God, is consecrating the feet of the priests because they will be the ones who will be standing in gap between God and the people. He is reenacting what Moses did in the Old Testament, in essence saying, I am the Jehovah God. I make you clean. I wash your feet. And that's why when Peter said, don't wash my feet, Jesus says, if you do not let me wash your feet, you have no part of me. You have nothing to do with me. Reason being that this has significance dating all the way back to Moses' time. You see, I am consecrating you. That means I have picked you as my servant. And if you're not going to be a part of it, then you have no part of me because you're breaking that tradition. That's the past to which Jesus is connecting this particular event to. Over and over and over, Jesus does what God did in the Old Testament. Let me give you another passage from the Old Testament that you're familiar with that points to this particular event. Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd. We all know that passage, right? But did you know verse 5? Verse 5 goes like this. You prepare a table before me, David says. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil and my cup overflows. Immediately after this event, it talks about Judas Iscariot. Judas, whatever you're to do, go do it quickly. But what is Jesus doing at this point with his disciples? He has a table out. He has food out, bread, communion bread, right? And wine. He set a table before the disciples in front of his enemies because people are going to come in and take him away. And Judas Iscariot, one of the enemies, was sitting right there in the midst of it. So you see literally how Jesus fulfilled Psalm 23, that he set a table before his disciples, his people, his sheep as a good shepherd, and protected them so that they can have peace. If this does not make you fall, want to fall on your knees and worship, I don't know what would. Right? He is the Jehovah God of the Old Testament, who is washing the feet, the gunk, off of the lowly disciples. That's our God. He demonstrated it. He connected it. Lastly, he entrusts it. He entrusts. He gives it to our trust so that we can serve one another like he did. He expects us to serve one another like he served us. Verse 13 says this. Jesus said, you call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you also should do, just as I have done to you. I believe the greatest evidence to the world that you are a Christian is not by living a good life. You know, it's not by coming to church. It's not by memorizing the Bible. It's not by listening to Matt Chandler all the time, or it's not listening to TBN or what have you. No. I think the greatest evidence is that you are serving your brothers and sisters like Jesus served us. When you undergird them, when you come underneath them, when you humble yourself and serve them, no matter their status, right? No matter their earnings, no matter their education, when you serve them, that the world will come in. Why is he doing that again? Because we don't do that in this world, right? Us, it's all about getting to the top. It's all, us all about, right, climb the corporate ladder. It's all about getting to be the guy so that we can be in control. But you are choosing to become lower. Why are you doing that? What is the reason for it? There must be something other than this world, right, that you're living for, and they will be exactly right. Listen, don't lose your chance at a reward in heaven by constantly seeking to associate with only important people. You're missing out. That's what the world does. It's about who you know. We all know that, right? It's not about what you know. We say that all the time. It's about who you know. So we need to associate with the right people. And Jesus says to us that the right people are the people that are anonymous, people that cannot help us back, people that are lowly, people that are undesirable. Serve them, Jesus says. That's where our reward is. As servants of one another, make the best of your time by associating and caring for little people, children, youth, others will have no physical benefit to you, right? That's why I respect the children's workers so much, because they don't get appreciated, right? We don't even know that they're there. We are here, but they're doing it unto the Lord, and I believe their reward will be the greatest, because nobody knows but God. And you know, that's what we'll be judged by in the end as Christians. I don't believe Billy Graham will be the first in line to see God. I don't believe it will be any of the big-time pastors at all. The people that are closest to God, people who will have the biggest crown or joy or happiness, are the people that you and I have never, ever heard of. And the people that have worked with the orphans, that have worked with the widows, that have given themselves anonymously, right, without fame, without reputation, without anything, simply serve them. Because that's exactly what Christ did. And he said, listen, whatever you have done for the least of these brothers of mine, you have done for me. Jesus said, whatever you have done, you want to get a reward? You want to do things directly for me? Do for the littlest of the people. And do not let your left hand know what your right hand has done, right? Then you're doing it unto me. You're serving me when you serve the little people without having anything in return in mind. Hard to do. Unless you have faith, you can't do this. Because what's in it for you, right? Nothing in it for you, other than what you get in heaven. We spend a good amount of time fantasizing being at the top, what we would do if we were in charge, but the servants of the Lord spend a good amount of time being at the bottom. Think about this, okay? Have you ever asked these questions to yourselves? How can I support everyone else better? How can I serve them better? How can I make their lives richer? What can I do for the good of this community? How can I ease their pain? What can I do to relieve them of their hardships? Is that what you struggle with? Is that what makes you stay up at night thinking about? Or is it about me, my future, my family, my children? Okay. Serving others. As you're listening to today's message, I hope your heart is filled with awesome demonstration of God's love for you, especially how the Old Testament was fulfilled by Jesus Christ, how he is the greatest servant of all. And us becoming a servant only comes as a reaction to that. Listen, worship is not about giving. Okay? I know you've heard many times, and those of you who are in my youth ministry, you've heard me say worship is about giving to the Lord, giving our worth to the Lord. That's secondary. There's something that has to come before that. You know what it is? Worship really, in essence, is about receiving. That's what gospel is. It's not what you do for God that matters. No, it's what God has done for us that matters, especially the cross. Right? That's the gospel. We can't do anything for the Lord. We're powerless. We're completely powerless. And out of sympathy, God loved us. Right? There's nothing worthy in us that God should love. It's purely because of who he is, how worthy he is that he loved us. And us receiving that is worship. And then what comes out of that as a reaction, as a response, is also worship. And that is serving one another, and that's where loving one another comes in only as a response to receiving that is truly worship, and it's not legalism and not religion, but love. Anonymously, humbly, and lovingly serving one another. And I want to end with this. Janet, my wife, just came back from a church starters' wives retreat yesterday, and she told me, she filled me in on some of the pastors that I knew, some of the churches, whose leaders I knew. And I mean, churches are just falling, shutting their doors or folding up left and right. You know, some churches have started before, slightly before we did, and then they folded up, and that church exists no longer. Some churches have started after we did. We're only 4 years old. And within that time, they have already started and they folded. Right? And these are godly people. These are praying people. Right? But almost in every single instant, the reason why they folded is exactly the same. You know why these churches closed their doors, these church plants? It's because they had nobody serving in their churches. It was almost always the pastor and his wife doing everything. And after doing it for a year or two, they just couldn't handle it anymore. So they just simply folded, right? We can't do this anymore. Financially, right? Physically, emotionally, we got to shut our doors. And I look at our church, right? I came in a little bit late today, like around 10, a little bit past 10, and I come here and everything's already set up. All the curtains are up, right? The stage is set up. Microphones all set up because Mr. Fejerang and Mr. Taylor are always here like 9:30 in the morning. Right? Marianne's always here, you know, doing her thing. And Chance, of course, even with the new baby, you know, he's setting up and everything. And all I got to do is, like, you know, act like I'm doing something, but really not doing anything. Right? I'm just looking over my message. And, of course, you know, there are people right now working with our children. And there are people that are working in the background, right, constantly that you don't know about. And you should envy them if you're not one of those people, because their reward is great in heaven. And I'm not going to start mentioning like everybody else, because there are too many of you, right, that are working behind the scenes. And I thank you. And that's why our church exists today. And it's going stronger than ever before. It's because there are people that are willing to serve one another. Let's do more of that, right? Let's learn from our master servant, and let's serve one another once again, right? Anonymously, right? Thankfully, right? Giving all glory and honor to God. Let's pray.